Hey everyone,
Nate,
Veronica,
and Lauren here
from Foodies Watching Movies.
Make sure to tune in every other Wednesday
for a podcast that's got tasty food talk
and epic movie discussions
right here on the Journey into Comics Network at journeyintocomics.com.
Hungry for more?
Go to the Journey into Comics Network Patreon
for early access and exclusive content
at patreon.com/journeyintocomics.
Following is a Journey into Comics Network production.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode 24 of The Poor Report. I am your host, Andrew Poor, and I want to thank you for joining me here today. And as you can hear in the background, I have a dog that decided now is the right time to drink from his water dish. So, always fun to start a show with a little bit of animal background noise. Now, I know on episode 23, I kind of just rushed right into the news because there was a lot to talk about with the Nunes memo and the State of the Union and everything that was going on at that time, and it was really all worth talking about. And this week was kind of a, I wouldn't say a slow week, because in the age of Trump and the age of the 24-hour news cycle, there's never really a slow news week. But I thought I'd kind of take a little step back and kind of talk a little bit about me and what's kind of been going on lately. So a show that I got into fairly recently, I've already kind of burned through the first four seasons, is... Sorry, my dog decided now it's also a good time to play ball. I just already burned through the first four seasons of The West Wing. Now, The West Wing is a show that ran from the late 90s to mid 2000s. So, the show centered around a White House and all of the staff under the president, a Democratic president played by Martin Sheen. And it was really interesting because I'd never got into it before despite liking politics and history and liking shows like House of Cards. So I'm kind of surprised why I never really got into it. But I started it and really just was fascinated by the ins and outs intricacies. And I've loved some of Aaron Sorkin's other shows like The Newsroom. And I recently saw his movies The Molly's Game, which I talked about, I believe, a couple episodes back or maybe on Foodies. It's hard to keep all of that straight sometimes. But the show is interesting, really thinking how all of this staff does all this behind the scenes that you really don't know about. And then at the same time, I was thinking about how these roles are filled in the current Trump administration, like with Sarah Huckabee Sanders filling in the role of C.J. Craig, and how all the other administrative people in the show. And it's really interesting when you think about it in that way, about how many people that you don't particularly like in the administration have these roles that are become a lot more focused, at least in this TV show setting, which I know is fictional, but it's, they didn't just make up their influence and their roles. They very much took care to make sure that these roles were accurate. They interviewed current White House staff. I know they worked with the Clinton administration and the Bush administration to interview some of their staff to make everything work. And yeah, it's been a great show. I've actually been holding myself back because I found a podcast through this that's done by someone who was on the show after season four, which I haven't got to yet because I'm holding myself back because I've already caught up to basically almost the current timeline of the podcast. It's a weekly run through of the show called West Wing Weekly. One that really drew me to the show is just the behind the scenes nature of it and the fact that you can see all the ins and outs of how the government worked, at least in this fictional world under a Democratic president. And it's a great story, and Aaron Sorkin does a beautiful job. So I encourage everyone to go listen to it. The podcast that goes through a week-to-week rundown from starting, I think it started middle of last year or early last year, and they're now in middle of season four, I believe, or towards the end of season four. So I'm currently at the beginning of season four, so I'm going to start slowing down and actually watching an episode, then listening to the recap. So I'm not just listening to old episodes well past trying to remember what was going on. But in the age of binge watching, it's really easy to just work through, like, I started this at the beginning of February, and I'm already in season four, and it's only the 12th, well, 13th by the time you're listening to this. So, yeah, definitely something to enjoy if you like my show and you like history, government, all of that. And that's really what's been going on with me lately. I've still been retooling the show, and as you've seen, the show's evolved. We started back a few episodes ago with The Poor Four, and then on last week's episode, I brought out The Poor Tour after some back and forth with some higher-ups in the network, mainly Nate, talking about the stuff like I've been on with my rants, like regarding like Tide Pods and service animals and stuff, that should make a good segment. So we came up with the Poor Retort, or Retort. So basically it's a topic that, or a news article or something that kind of irked me. I can kind of go on a rant about it. And I think I have a good one for you guys for today, which I think will anger some other listeners of the network and maybe in some of the people that do shows on the network. So we'll see how that goes. Hopefully I don't lose any listeners over it, but I think it's a good point worth bringing up. And usually I save the Poor Retort segment for the end of the show, but I think it'd be fitting to kind of jump into it now because it's very fresh given kind of what's going on lately. And I think my Poor Retort segment is on superhero movies and superhero movie fans. And not necessarily super, but like big blockbusters. So I'm going to extend it out beyond just superhero movies to like Star Wars and the other big box office smashes that have active fan followings. Look at the DC movies, Star Wars movies, Marvel movies, broader Sony, MCU, all of that stuff that goes along with it. And I've seen it before. Fans of these movies are the most passionate fans, and they're also the most hard-to-please fans out there. And it really goes back to like what my original story kind of before earlier this week when I was kind of prepping the show was how since last year when Disney announced that they were acquiring Fox and all of the entertainment version, which included all of the Marvel properties that Disney and Marvel didn't already own, like the X-Men, Fantastic Four, all of these other additional characters, or some of the cornerstones of the Marvel comic universe. And basically, as soon as that info dropped, they're like, we have plans to acquire, it's going to be a long process. They're like, oh, will Wolverine be in Infinity War? Will Deadpool be affected by the Disney acquisition? And they're talking about movies that are coming months away that, oh, maybe they could do this or that. I'm like, you realize this is a major, major acquisition that there's ins and outs of it that we don't fathom. There's a lot of backroom stuff that's with us to go through anti-monopoly issues and just to make sure that this company is not becoming too powerful because it's acquired recently, like Pixar and Marvel and Lucasfilm. It's required all these companies, and now they're adding another chunk to their repertoire. They're essentially closing one entertainment studio to become this larger corporation, which is great because everyone thinks in theory, like, they get all this stuff back, but you gotta think that it's a very slow process. You're looking at two major corporations and a government and bureaucracy that's gonna slow everything way down. We're not gonna see these characters for some time, but people are passionately like, oh, maybe there'll be this in there. Like, I remember seeing a picture of Thanos close up and there's like three lines under his eye, and people are like, oh, maybe that's a Wolverine scar. Maybe we'll see Wolverine in the MCU. No, you're not gonna see him yet. I mean, Kevin Feige came out and said, like, we have no plans until after 2020. We're planned up to that point, and all of our groundwork's in place. We're not going to add something just because it's available. The only reason the Sony deal with Spider-Man worked was because they really pushed for it. They moved mountains, and everything was a lot simpler because they weren't acquiring rights back. They just were kind of licensing him, and they had this weird little partnership, and it co-produced the Spider-Man Homecoming, and there's still a Spider-Verse out there that I'll get to in a minute that involves movies that they're making that aren't tied to the MCU but are still tied to the Spider-Verse, like this Venom movie that's coming out later this year. And I found an article I really wanted to talk about that was talking to Bob Iger recently about the acquisition, and I have kind of two quotes. Basically, he goes on to say, Iger went on to explain that the merger is yet to go through and has to navigate a grueling legal process with the federal government's regulators before it will officially be approved. He said, before we discuss the quarter and other developments across the company, a quick update about our recently announced acquisition. The regulatory process has begun in numerous jurisdictions across the world, and I spent the last several weeks meeting with a number of business leaders at Fox, gaining insights that will be invaluable when it comes to integrating our organizations once we have regulatory approval. After these discussions, I'm even more enthusiastic about the business we're acquiring and the management teams that are leading them. Furthermore, Iger elaborated on what Disney's agenda for the soon-to-be subsidiary will be. He said, as we said when we announced this deal, there are three primary strategic priorities fulfilled by this acquisition. It will deliver more content and the production capabilities and talent to produce even more. It will enhance our direct-to-consumer initiatives with platforms, technologies, brands, and existing customer relationships to build on. And it will greatly diversify our business geographically. All three of these elements sync up perfectly with our own core strategies, and all three are designed to create growth in a very dynamic global marketplace. So it has started. They are putting in the steps to get this done, but it's not going to be done in 2018. It's probably not even going to be done in most of 2019, if not all of 2019. We're not going to see anything close to this until 2020 at the earliest. And even that, it might be in its early stages. They're not going to... That means you're not going to see them be able to make a movie with those characters starting filming until 2020, which means we're not going to see these movies with them in it until late 2020, early 2021. And Kevin Feige and the guys at Marvel have to plan accordingly for that. They might shoehorn in an after-credit scene featuring someone, but you're not going to see a movie with major focus on these at least for three more years. And I think the fans that are passionate and they want to see this, it's all fine and good, but you got to realize you're going to be waiting a while, and you can't be upset when Infinity comes out, or Infinity War comes out, and the sequel to Infinity War comes out, and all these subsequent Marvel films, like, oh, where's this, where's that? It's going to be a while, and I think once you dial in your expectations and realize that this is a major acquisition, there's a lot of moving parts that have to kind of go align, and it could turn out that the federal government could say, no, you can't, and then the deal's off. And then it's back to the drawing board. And recently we heard talk that, oh, Sony properties may be on the chopping block because there's a CEO change and this new CEO is focusing on the electronics and the merchandise and the technology side of things and not so much of the film and TV and the production side of things. So they may be selling off that aspect. And people are like, oh, maybe Disney will acquire that. And Disney will most likely not be acquiring that or even any pieces of that because... If they're trying to approve the Marvel acquisition or the Marvel asset acquisition with Fox and everything, they're not going to be able to do a simultaneous one with Sony. That'll just be a nightmare, and it's more likely for one or both of those to fail. So people need to chill and realize that just because you want something doesn't mean you're going to get it and it's not going to come soon. I feel like we've been entitled in our generation to get a lot of stuff that people in the generation above us couldn't get because of the way the world was working, the entertainment industry was working. Now we're in an age of superhero movies and movies coming about properties that we love. And we've been spoiled by it. And we got to realize that all this stuff is going to take time and you can't just expect it. We have to be adults and we have to realize that this will come in due time and it's going to be worth the wait. But you can't rush these things. When you rush something, you get something like the reboot of Fantastic Four. So you just gotta wait and see and hope for the best. You gotta dial in expectations. Which brings me to another thing with people regarding superhero films and Star Wars films is the fact that I think the trailers for big budget box office films like Marvel and DC and Star Wars are almost getting to a point where they're sharing too much information, and it's been so much that when a movie doesn't give away the big reveal or give away a lot of details, people are upset by it. Like, I've seen it a lot recently with the fact that the Venom movie that's coming out in October doesn't have Venom in it, in like full Venom form, like what you saw in Spider-Man 3, for those of you who remember that movie, which is a whole other topic that we could get into on Foodies or something else. I'm not going to talk about it here, but you know, Venom, big black suit, big white gaping mouth, big white eyes. That guy. Well, we heard that Sony was going to make movies set in the Spider-Verse that weren't tied to the MCU, despite rumors that maybe Tom Holland will appear as Peter Parker in that movie and give some weird, very tiny webbing, to the between the two universes. Maybe living if ever Sony or Marvel does, Marvel as a subsidiary of Disney acquires the Spider assets, that maybe they could tie that in easier. But people are upset that Venom's not in it. They're like, oh, Venom should be in this movie. We didn't see pictures of it. We don't know what this movie's about. And I don't know. Maybe I'm just of the kind. Like, I watched the trailer. I thought it was pretty good. It gave me hints. It kind of reminded me a lot of the Hulk in those regards, that you see the man changing, but you don't get the payoff. And I think we've been spoiled by movies that give away at least the skeleton of the plot. They give away major plot points. Like, I know before even seeing Infinity War, at least a good chunk of who's in it, who the villain is, what's going to happen, a lot of destruction, and I can basically write down a rough plot that's going to be filled in by details. We know Thorin's up on the Milano, and we know that they're going to come to Earth, and we know that Tony's going to be with Doctor Strange, and Hulk's going to crash into the Sanctum Sanctorum, and we know Spider-Man's going to end up on this big ship, and Thanos is going to be there, and he's going to do damage to Spider-Man and Tony and all of them, and he has his children with him, and we know all of this without even getting to really where it's going to start dropping TV spots. That's just from the trailer we saw from the Super Bowl last week. Like, we're given a lot of information that when we're not given that, we're like, oh, where is this? Where is that? Where is what I need? Or, like, the Star Wars one. Like, we just saw the Han Solo trailer, and we see, for one while, the characters, like, we look, see them being chased. Like, that one actually wasn't too bad. I will kind of dial back on the Star Wars hate. Is the Star Wars has been relatively loose in terms of major spoilers in their movies. Like, at least the first Han Solo teaser, which maybe because it is a teaser, and maybe when we get the full trailer, we get another trailer, we're going to get more details, but we see the Millennium Falcon in its new form and shape and glory, and we see the new Han Solo, we see Chewbacca, we see Lando, we see Woody Harrelson's character, and we see Daenerys in that movie. We get bits and pieces, and we kind of get a rough idea of what's going to happen, but it's not as spoilerific as what we've got in Marvel films, and even DC films for that matter have been big on plot spoiling. We saw it with Suicide Squad, we saw it with Justice League, we've seen things that have almost given away the whole thing. And I have a friend who I sometimes make fun of a little bit for how far he goes to avoid watching trailers before the movies for movies he really wants to see, because he wants to go in unspoiled. He wants to see something for the first time. And it also helps avoid, like, if something changes between when a trailer's cut, when the final film is released, you'd be like, oh, where's that scene? Or where's this? Like, I remember when I watched The Last Jedi that you saw some lines between Rey and Kylo Ren where they may form an alliance, and they cleverly cut two scenes together with dialogue and voiceover and all of that to make it seem one thing, but it's something else. But you still got that story in one way or another, and you see a lot that was going on. I don't know. I think we're grown to expect certain things, so that's what they're giving us. And I think, because, like, if you go see a trailer for a movie that's not a big budget film, like an indie film, you're not getting the same level of plot or the same level of story it's told you. You're given just enough to make you want to go see that. You're the one where it's like, you turn out like, oh, I want to see that. I don't really know what it's about, but it looks intriguing, and I kind of want to check that out in theaters. In the age of Movie Pass, where we're able to see a lot more films than we were before, it's something else that we can do. And really, I'm going to get off my soapbox. I know those of you who disagree with everything I just said are probably like, your show's about news and politics. Why are you saying that? But it's still entertainment news. I understand everyone has their opinion. That's just mine. So I'll get off my soapbox and kind of get back into the story. And I'll really jump right into my Poor Four, which has some Trump news and some interesting news around the world, plus the Olympics and everything else that's been going on. So I'll kind of jump right into that. So we had word over the last week of a former president, that president being George W. Bush, saying that Russia meddled in the 2016 presidential election. He was in Abu Dhabi for reasons, and he said, this was last Thursday, that there's pretty clear evidence that Russians meddled. Whether that affected the outcome is another question. He never, like, names Donald Trump by name, but he says, he also, like, goes on further to say, like, it's problematic that a foreign nation is involved in our election system. Our democracy is only as good as the people, as people trust the results. So it's kind of interesting that we haven't really heard much from former presidents regarding Trump. We know that, I remember on the show I covered, actually quite a few episodes now, it was probably later last fall, when all the presidents got together for hurricane relief and did that kind of event. So all everyone from Carter, both Bushes, everyone kind of assembled for that. But we never really get to see much of criticism of current presidents. And I just picked up this audiobook from my library called The Last Republicans, which is about George Bush and George H.W. Bush. Or George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush. So as the last Republicans, because they're the last two Republicans of the Republican Party that we know. I know the Republican Party has kind of evolved under Trump, and it's not the same as what it once was. And I guess Bush was getting interviewed, so we kind of set this up, and one thing he goes on to talk about is that he kind of criticized the decision of Trump to scrap the program implemented by former President Barack Obama's administration that allows young immigrants living in the U.S. illegally who were brought here as children to remain in America, or like the DACA deal or the Dreamers and all these people. And George Bush goes on to say, America's their home. They've got to get it fixed. Bush acknowledged that he's tried to overhaul America's broken immigration system, but failed. He says, there are people willing to do jobs that Americans won't do. Americans don't want to pick cotton at 105 degrees, but there are people who want to put food on their family's table and are willing to do that. We ought to say thank you and welcome them. And it's crazy that just over a decade ago, people were criticizing George W. Bush for some of the things he said or did, or some of his views on the war and the way things went with that towards the latter term of his presidency, post 9/11, when we were involved in Iraq and Afghanistan and everything that was going on there. And now it seems like Bush is now the voice of reason in the era of Trump. So kind of interesting, and it kind of goes into like what happened else beyond the Russia stuff, kind of keeping the same vein of Russia, is that I talked last week when I was talking about the Nunes, maybe that Democrats were going to push their memo if it's not blocked by Trump, and lo and behold, Trump blocked the Democrats' rebuttal memo. President Donald Trump blocked the release of the memo written by Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee as a rebuttal to allegations from their Republican counterparts that the FBI abused surveillance laws to improperly spy on the Trump campaign. In a letter to the White House Intelligence Committee on Friday, White House counsel Don McGahn said that while the president is inclined to declassify the memo, he will not at this time due to it containing numerous properly classified and especially sensitive passages. He goes on to say the executive branch stands ready to review any subsequent drafts for declassification at the earliest opportunity. The White House also shared a letter from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Christopher Wray, expressing concerns about the release of certain parts of the memo. The letter came in response to McGahn's request for the FBI and DOJ to review the Democratic memo and argued that certain passages sparked concern about the protection of intelligent sources and methods, ongoing investigations, and other sensitive information. And interesting that Rosenstein and Wray also expressed similar concerns to the GOP-drafted memo that Trump did read, supposedly, and agree to release last week. Because earlier in the week, the White House Intelligence Committee voted to release the Democratic memo. The Republicans on the committee blocked the Democrats' memo being released simultaneously. Rep. Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, slammed the Republican memo as misleading and factually incorrect. He said in a statement last week that his party's response would provide missing context that would refute Republicans' claims. Several of the allegations in the Nunes memo are already falling apart. One of the key complaints in the memo is that the FBI failed to disclose that a dossier compiled by former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele was funded by Democratic operatives looking for information on Trump during the campaign. But 3 days after the memo was released, Nunes conceded that the FBI had disclosed the political origins of the Steele dossier in a footnote on its application to spy on Page. Nunes's memo also claimed that Andrew McCabe, then deputy director of the FBI, told the House Intelligence Committee last December that the agency wouldn't have sought a surveillance warrant without the Steele dossier. Nunes's staff purposely mischaracterizes McCabe's testimony in the memo, a senior Democratic committee official told Huffington Post. The minority's memo lays out all the full facts, which is kind of what goes on to say the Democratic memo did very much be a rebuttal and proves a lot of statements in the Nunes memo as false or inaccurate or misleading. So, hard to say if we'll ever see the Democratic memo, but we know that the Republican memo was pretty much a dud, like I talked about last week's episode, and we'll see if we ever see the Democratic memo, or if it gets redacted and changed enough that we can't make heads or tails of it. And I know Trump put a tweet out saying basically the Democrats made this memo, put a lot of stuff in it that know that couldn't be released just so we could block it so they could have more time, and say that we're saying that basically the Democrats put something out there that they would have to be blocked, and then they could look like they're the victims in the story. And it's a big mess, and Trump's based on the side whoever gets him out of what's going on, so we'll kind of have to see how the rest of this shakes out. Another big thing that happened was that we had our second government shutdown, and I feel like I just talked about a shutdown on an earlier episode, and that's because this is the second government shutdown of 2018, and it's only the middle of February. Luckily, the shutdown only lasted for about 5.5 hours, so that's always fun. And Trump, after it was finally settled at around, he put a tweet about 8:40, but it basically like 5:30 or so, they voted to kind of put everything back in action. He said, President Trump tweeted that just signed bill, our military will now be stronger than ever before. We love and need our military and gave them everything and more. First time this has happened in a long time, and also means jobs, jobs, jobs. Woo! More jobs, jobs, jobs. For now, anyway. So I guess the vote was around 5:30. It was 240 in favor and 186 against. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi had urged her members to oppose the bill over the GOP's fail to resolve the standoff over 700,000 Dreamers, which is what I talked about in the Bush section of the Poor Four. But our efforts ultimately fell short. 73 Democrats ended up backing the bipartisan package, which came after months of closed-door talks. The defeat was a bitter one for Pelosi and other top Democrats, who had sought for months to tie a resolution of the fight over the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program to the budget cap negotiations. Another representative from North Carolina said she didn't have a cohesive message, and at the end of the day, her team broke. It's a fascinating display of bipartisan win, and at the same time, Democrats ripping themselves apart about a bipartisan agreement. It doesn't make any damn sense. I guess what belongs with this funding bill is, in addition to tens of billions of dollars in new funding for both the Pentagon and domestic programs, the budget package will keep federal agencies open until March 23rd. So maybe on March 23rd we'll have another shutdown, because that's the world we're living in. This will give time for the House and Senate appropriations panels to craft a massive $1.3 trillion omnibus spending bill that will fund federal agencies until September 30th, which may have another shutdown. Yay, shutdowns. Speaker Paul Ryan said, "This is a great victory for our men and women in uniform. Republicans and Democrats joined together to finally give our troops the resources and our generals the certainty to plan for the future." Senate Democrats also claim victory, especially Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who helped craft the deal along with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other House leaders. He said, "What makes Democrats proudest of this bill is that after a decade of cuts to programs that help the middle class, we have a dramatic reversal. Funding for education, infrastructure, fighting drug abuse, and medical research will all, for the first time in years, get very significant increases, and we have placed Washington on a path to deliver more help to the middle class in the future." Yet, the Senate vote came only after Senator Rand Paul refused to allow any action on the measure before the midnight funding deadline, triggering the second government shutdown in 3 weeks and an embarrassing outcome for the GOP-controlled Congress. Paul blocked consideration of the measure because he didn't get a vote on an amendment to keep Congress under strict budget caps, as well as stripping the debt limit from the package. GOP and Democratic leaders in the Senate feared it would, if they let Paul proceed with his proposal, other senators would seek to amend the underlying deal as well, so they refused to allow Paul's proposal. Basically, if they would have let Paul do it, they would have opened up a can of worms and went back to the drawing board, and they just wanted to get this bill signed and out there so they could kind of move on to other things. So, at midnight, the federal shutdown began, and the Office of Personnel Management emailed federal employees to make it official. The email says, "Due to a lapse in appropriations, federal government operations vary by agency. Employees should refer to their home agency for guidance on reporting for duty." Even after all the Senate drama, passage in the House was not a sure bet either. Opposition from GOP conservatives required Republican leaders to lean on Democrats for votes, even as Pelosi took a hard line on Dreamers. In the end, dozens of her rank and file rejected Pelosi's plea and supported the package. We have a moment they didn't have the votes, Pelosi declared inside the meeting, according to two sources. Pelosi said Democrats need to use their leverage on the budget deal to extract concessions from Ryan on resolving the standoff over Dreamers. Ryan played up a big boost in defense spending in order to placate Republicans while also trying to reassure Pelosi and wavering Democrats that he's resolved to coming up with a solution for Dreamers. He said, "I know there's a real commitment to solving the DACA challenge in both political parties. That's a commitment that I share. If anyone doubts my intentions to solve the problem and bring up a DACA and immigration reform bill, do not. We will bring a solution to the floor once the president will sign." Trump canceled the DACA program last year and called on Congress to come up with a legislative fix he can support. Despite months of bipartisan talks, congressional leaders have failed to do so, leading to last month's government shutdown and question over whether Congress can pass a budget cap deal. Ryan had hoped his last statement, a different version of what he's already promised, would provide enough Democrats the political cover they needed to vote for a budget deal, but it wasn't enough for Pelosi. And then after this all happened, Trump put out a tweet that said, "Republicans want to fix DACA far more than Democrats do. The Dems had all three branches of government back in 2008 to 2011, and they decided not to do anything about DACA. The only one to use it as a campaign issue, vote Republican." And this is a tweet that has four things wrong with it. One, Bush was actually president in 2008 because Obama, even though he was elected in 2008, didn't take office until January 2009. The Dems lost control of the House in 2010 because that was the 2010 midterm elections. DACA wasn't created until 2012, so there was no DACA discussions prior to 2011 when he made that tweet. And the fourth thing is, if he got all of that wrong in one tweet, why is he speaking on it at all? So, yeah, lots of fun on that. And before we get out of Trump news, there's something else I want to talk about. And that involves allegations finally hitting the White House officially regarding abuse. And this isn't tied to the sexual abuse we have dealt with in other businesses and Hollywood and all the other acts. This is actually involving physical and emotional and violent abuse. And this involves two White House officials. So, on Friday, a White House speechwriter resigned after his former wife claimed that he was violent and emotionally abusive during their turbulent 2.5-year marriage, allegation that he vehemently denied, saying she was the one who victimized him. The abrupt departure of David Sorensen, that's his name, a speechwriter worked under senior policy advisor Stephen Miller, came as the Washington Post was reporting on a story about abuse claim by his ex-wife Jessica Corbett. Corbett told the Post that she described his behavior to the FBI last fall as the Bureau was conducting a background check on Sorensen. White House officials have learned of the accusation by Sorensen's wife Thursday night before the Post contacted the White House for comment. We immediately confronted the staffer. He denied the allegations and he resigned today, spokesman Raj Shah said in a statement Friday evening. In a text message to the Post, Sorensen said he stepped down because he didn't want to see the White House to have to deal with this distraction. He said he should be able to focus on continuing President Trump's historic accomplishments for the American people. Sorensen's resignation comes 2 days after another administration official, Staff Secretary Rob Porter, departed after two ex-wives said he physically abused them. Senior White House officials and the FBI knew about the allegations for months, raising questions about why he was allowed to remain in his post. Administration officials said Sorensen's position as a speechwriter at the Council on Environmental Quality Division of the Executive Office of the President did not require security clearance. His background check was ongoing, they said. The FBI declined request for comment. So two people with very similar backgrounds, so it seems, regarding spousal abuse and other violence and emotional abuse problems are now plaguing the White House. And this led Trump to make a very surprising tweet, which I guess isn't all that surprising given Trump. He said, "People's lives are being shattered and destroyed by a mere allegation. Some are true and some are false. Some are old and some are new. There is no recovery for someone falsely accused. Life and career are gone. Is there no such thing any longer as due process?" Which, coming from Trump, is kind of a crazy tweet to make. And he made this on, I think it was Saturday morning. Trump basically said, this is after he criticized Harvey Weinstein, all these people on the Democratic... It's basically, as soon as it affected him in any way, he's now against allegations ruining lives. But when it was affecting Hollywood and other industries, he was praising the condemnation of these elitists and these liberals and all of that. And now that it's struck close to home, he's now changed his tune, which is kind of how Trump is, the way I'm kind of gathering. If Trump likes you, he likes you. If you're against Trump, he will criticize you. And sometimes that can affect the same person. Like, you know how much he praised Steve Bannon going through the election and into office. And now that after the whole book issue and all that, now essentially Bannon's on a shit list amongst other people. And yeah, it seems crazy that we're now dealing with kind of the chaos that's going on with that. And yeah, it's just got to be a crazy world to live in Trump's White House and deal with all what they deal with. And after really watching Speechless, different show altogether. And after watching The West Wing and seeing how that White House operates versus this White House, I really wish those were reversed. I would much rather watch a TV show about the crazy shenanigans that go on in a Trump White House and have a Martin Sheen presidential White House or Jed Bartlett run in its place. Because I think that would be a lot smoother, and we'd have a press secretary that was Allison Janney instead of Sarah Huckabee Sanders. So, hopeful wishing, but hopefully this nightmare only lasts 4 years. And I guess getting away from Trump news, finally, there's a couple other things I want to talk about, and really Trump news is going to kind of crescendo the first point of the Poor Force. There's three other things I want to talk about here quickly, because I know we're already approaching the 40-ish minute mark of my show, which I will definitely make sure it doesn't go over an hour like we had last time. So, a couple of big things that happened kind of outside the world of the Trump world is SpaceX, which is something that's clearly out of this world. So, Elon Musk, as you know, I talked about last week how he was selling flamethrowers and all that. So, Elon Musk, the founder of SpaceX, just launched his own personal Tesla Roadster into space on the front of one of the largest rockets built in years. In the driver's seat is Starman, a mannequin in a spacesuit, also designed by SpaceX. While it is a bit problematic in the car's total use in space, it is the personal flair we have come to know from Musk as he continues to drive mankind into the stars. And I didn't really know this was happening. I didn't know that there was this big rocket launch and they were putting a payload into space. So all of a sudden I just saw a picture of it. Look, I thought it really was an astronaut. I didn't realize it was a mannequin in a Tesla Roadster just with the Earth in the background. I was like, what in the world did I miss on the news? So it turns out, yeah, it was a mannequin, and it was Elon Musk's personal Tesla Roadster that was the payload for the rocket. Kind of the article goes on to say, but don't let his flair for the ridiculous fool you. SpaceX is continuing to make headway into the space industry. The rocket launch was another step forward in the private company's space flight progress, testing one of the most powerful rockets on Earth against a heavy payload, that being the Tesla Roadster, and to get those very large rockets to safely land back on Earth so they can be reused, which is something that we haven't seen with NASA. Basically, those rockets are going to crash into the ocean and be done and have to build a new one for billions and billions of dollars. So these landing reusable rockets is something that SpaceX has been doing for decades. About a decade, with a dozen or so successful attempts, but this was by far the largest rocket they've attempted. Musk told reporters that, given a successful test flight, the next Falcon Heavy could launch within 3 to 6 months, and make no mistake, Tuesday's launch was a successful flight. Only two events didn't go as planned. The center core of the three-booster first stage missed its drone ship landing and crashed into the Atlantic Ocean. So, The two side rockets landed successfully. I saw the video, which was really impressive when you see two large ones that launched a payload into space, then land back down safely so they can be cleaned up, set up for the next run. And only the big, large center one didn't land successfully and crashed into the ocean. And hey, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. That's still a passing grade if you're grading on a curve. But hey, it's still better than what we've had in NASA for decades and decades and decades. The other thing that didn't go as planned was the final engine burn on the rocket's second stage was stronger than expected, sending the Falcon's heavy unique payload, that being the Tesla Roadster with the mannequin named Starman, into an orbit that extends out to the asteroid belt beyond the orbit of Mars as initially planned. So I guess it was planned to be put into Mars's orbit, so there'd just be a car, little red Tesla Roadster with a mannequin in it, just rolling through space around Mars, and now it's rolling through space around an asteroid belt, which got to be weird for if there's any life out there, just comes across like a car with a mannequin in it and be like, what? Or however they, whatever life on, that's a whole nother topic. I feel like as it was going to space, you should be playing that that Life on Mars song that I don't really remember who initially sang it. I just remember it from the American Horror Story episode. And really, that's it for Tesla news. I'll keep you updated because Elon Musk tends to live a very interesting life, and we saw his flamethrowers and his underground tunnel with high-speed transportation. Now we see him launch a car into space. So we'll keep you updated with really what comes next. Two other interesting things to talk about that were both interesting news this week. And one was that six teenagers entered the governor's race in Kansas. Which I saw and I was like, what? Okay, so I guess according to Kansas, to vote in Kansas, you must be 18 years old. You need to show a photo ID at your polling place and show proof of U.S. citizenship when you register to vote. But when it comes to the rules about who can run for the state office, there are no rules. I guess up to this point, there's never been an issue because only older people have run for governor. And it's I think the rules are very much set in stone in all other 50 states. So I guess under the Kansas law, there's no law governing the qualifications for governor. Not one. Brian Caskey, director of elections at the Kansas Secretary's office. So there's seriously nothing on the books that lay out anything, no age, no residency, no experience, no nothing. So in theory, I could run for governor of Kansas. An Illinois resident who's registered to vote in Illinois could, in theory, run for governor of Kansas. And there's no law that says I can't, which is kind of ridiculous, and I'm surprised no one's ever noticed this before. But apparently it took a bunch of teens in high school to do this, and they can't even vote for themselves, which is ridiculous. So I guess something about these kids. So I guess once these kids found out, I'm going to call them kids because they're teenagers and I'm an adult. So into the race jumped Jack Bergensen. He calls himself an anti-establishment candidate. He's 17 years old and he's pursuing the Democratic nomination, advocating for a $12 minimum wage, legalization of medical marijuana, and a high-speed rail for major cities in the region, which isn't a bad platform to run on, I guess. He said, and I quote, "I thought, you know, let's give the people of Kansas a chance. Let's try something new that has never been tried anywhere else before." Three more teen boys running as Republicans soon entered the governor's race, so many that they had their own candidates forum in a high school gym in Lawrence, Kansas. High school kids meeting in a high school gym to run for governor. What world are we living in? Oh my gosh. I guess one of the other candidates, this needs to be a government that represents everyone, not just 30 years old up, said 17-year-old candidate Dominic Scavuzzo. Two more teen boys threw hats in the ring, spurring Kansas lawmakers to try and put a stop to such youthful exuberance. Republican Rep. Blake Carpenter introduced a bill requiring candidates to be at least 18 years old to run to the state's top elected offices, such as governor, Secretary of State or Attorney General, and candidates for governor and lieutenant governor would have to be lived in the state for 4 years. He says, "We have age requirements on voters, and I really think that anybody who's running should be able to vote for themselves," Rep. Keith Issa, a Republican running for Secretary of State, told the Topeka Capital Journal. The Star reports that the bill passed out of House committee on Monday. He says, I don't think it's a good thing, Bergson, now 17, told the Star. I'm not a fan of it. I think it's a reactionary bill. I think it's trying to disenfranchise candidates. The law wouldn't take effect until after the November election, and that's important, said Caskey at the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State does not want there to be any appearance of a conflict of interest concerning persons who are currently candidates and do not meet these proposed requirements. He's referring to the Secretary of State, Chris Kobach, the force behind the state's strict voter ID law, who is running for governor. Kobach was also co-chair of President Trump's controversial voting commission, which was dissolved last month. But their anything-goes system that has been so appealing to Kansas teenagers has been less appealing to one group, which is women. State Senator Laura Kelly, a Democrat, became the first woman to enter the crowded field for governor in December. Meanwhile, more than 20 men or boys have declared their candidacy. The state's lack of rules for candidacy are so profound that Cassie could not even find a rule limiting the field to human candidates. A dog has never tried to file, he told the Star last year. I don't know what would happen if one tried to. So, they're passing a bill that's going to change this for future elections, but this election still has a bunch of teenagers running and some older people and a woman and all of this. So, another crazy turn of events in the world that we live in involving teenagers running for governor of Kansas. But it's Kansas, so who really cares, right? No, I'm just kidding. Kansas is a great state. It's the setting of another show I like, which is Supernatural, which I'm not current on because I got behind, and then I was too behind the 5 episodes you can watch on demand, so I'm going to wait till Netflix gets it next, or later in the spring. So, yeah, random side tangent, but yeah, we'll have to see how that election shakes out. I'm assuming it's going to crowd the party, and none of those boys are going to get enough votes to make it work, because all of their friends can't vote for them because they're teenagers. So we're probably going to get the guy who's against it, who's is in favor of stronger ID laws and worked on Trump's campaign, or maybe it's going to be that woman who thinks it's crazy that what's going on, or maybe we'll have a dog elected. Who knows? It's Kansas. What can you expect? I think another thing that kind of happened this week was that we're now in Olympic territory, the 2018 Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, happened. They opened over a little bit last week, and I actually watched a couple of the events over the weekend, like curling and figure skating and snowboarding and some of the stuff that I've already competed on. So just a little bit of news there for those of you who are not aware or don't follow sports or the Olympics or anything like that. So a couple things that are interesting. NHL players can't compete in hockey this year. I feel like the last Winter Olympics they could. So we don't have NHL players competing on the hockey team, so it's all amateurs, which is probably for the best, especially since we're still in the current hockey season and they can't just stop playing hockey games. I know there's a Blackhawks game in Vegas on Tuesday because my future in-laws are going to be at that game. So I guess also other thing that's going on is that Russians aren't there. Russians aren't allowed to compete. And North Koreans are going to be there. They've united under the flag of South Korea, so now I was under one Korea, and that's how they're competing. So, no Russians, both Koreas competing under one Korea. I guess for those who don't know, Russia was banned from the Olympics for a blatant and rampant system of doping. Now, some Russians are allowed to compete, but in the grand tradition of inane sports penalties, they are not allowed to compete for Russia, but merely as people from Russia. Their official designation, which I've seen in some of the scoring and competitions, is a white logo with the Olympic medals, and their names are Olympic athletes from Russia. So, yeah, which is weird. They just can't say Russians. You're now Olympic athletes from Russia. And I don't know what happens if they win. Do they just play nothing for a bit? Do you get to pick out your own song? Like, can you play Beyonce Single Ladies because you're not technically from a country, so they don't have to play your national anthem? I don't know. We'll have to see how that shakes out. A couple big things that happened. Chris Mazur, who won the first individual medal in men's luge in U.S. history, spoke of being touched by the gesture of a Russian luger who offered Len Mazur a sled last month to see if it would help him get over a slump. I think what it shows is that we do care about each other, and there's this human connection we have that crosses countries, crosses cultures, and sport is an amazing way to accomplish that. So, good for them. A medal for the U.S. I guess a norovirus outbreak has made the headlines with 194 confirmed cases from February 1st through February 12th, which is not great news. Like I said before, the North and South Korea marched an opening ceremony together as a unified Korean team, drawing some of the biggest applause of the night. We are all touched by this wonderful gesture, IOC President Thomas Bach said in his speech. The North Korean cheer squad made appearances around the games, livening up the atmosphere and generally drawing praise for their enthusiasm. We also saw the shirtless Tongan flag bearer that I guess was at the last Olympics, not the winter, but the summer still shirtless in the sub freezing open temp, and I guess he qualified as a cross country skier, which is interesting. Red Gerard, a 17-year-old, so hey, 17-year-olds are all doing things now. I guess whose brother built a rail park in the backyard for him, won the United States first medal, a gold in men's slope style. While Gerard was getting ready to put down his winning run, his family was shotgunning beers, which, if nothing sounds more American than while you're about to compete, your family is shotgunning beers. And Mirai Nagasu announced her return to the Olympics in dramatic fashion. Nagasu, who finished fourth in 2010 but was passed over for a spot 4 years ago, became the first U.S. woman to land the triple axel at the Olympics during the team competition. And if I don't, if I'm not remembering right, I apologize, but I think that was what Tanya Harding was hoping to do at the Olympics, and she was doing in qualifiers up to it. I may be wrong, I'd have to look that up, but I saw Tanya last week, which I talked about on Foodies Watching Movies, which you'll hear about tomorrow. Some more timey-wimey stuff, but hey, good stuff for that. And really, that comes to the end of the Poor Four segment for this week. So we talked about Trump and everything that's going on with that. We talked about West Wing, with everything that's going on with that. We talked about everything that's going on, like I said, with Trump's White House. We saw Kansas kids entering the governor's race. We saw SpaceX launch a car with a mannequin in it into space. And we saw Olympics and all the fun stuff that's going on in Pyeongchang, South Korea. So that's really all I want to talk about for this week. I am Andrew Poor. This is the Poor Report. This is episode 24. Some exciting stuff and some changes to the show are coming with 25, and I can't wait for you guys to hear them. But until then, have a great week, and remember that in a world of fake news, the media has to represent the governed, not the governors. And that's it. Thanks, guys.